Hello and welcome to this week's edition of On Science. I'm Christopher Joyce, and this is the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at National Public Radio. It's been a sort of slow week for science. The economy still seems to be taking up most of our airtime, but now and then, those of us on the Science Desk do get to get on the air, and this week, I got to do a science story that was pretty peculiar, the kind of thing I like to do about how, I guess you'd say, how weird nature is. And how scientists now and then get to find out stuff with a new gadget that they'd never found out before. And that's exactly what happened with ocean scientists who tested an advanced form of sonar out in the North Atlantic. It revealed something quite amazing beneath the surface, an enormous gathering of herring, as many as half a billion. The scientists described their discovery in the journal Science, and here's what happened when they went out and pointed the device down. Nicholas McCreese doesn't know much about fish. He's an engineer. But the device he invented, a powerful kind of sonar that can scan wide swaths of the ocean, got biologists pretty excited. McCreese and a team of those biologists took his device out into the North Atlantic, to the George's Bank, a hotspot for marine life. It was, he says, a shot in the dark. But soon, one of his colleagues saw something unusual on the sonar screen and told everyone to keep an eye out.
Hey, you better watch what's going to happen here and stick around here because I think you're going to see something. And she said, just watch, just watch, just watch. And there it happened. It was really amazing.
At sunset, herring that were spread out near the bottom of the ocean started to drift closer to each other. When they reached a critical density, the fish suddenly started to group into clumps. As each fish synchronized its movements with nearby fish, the clumps rapidly coalesced into a vast school 25 miles across. On the sonar screen, McCreese says it looked like the kind of wave created by spectators in a sports stadium.
Somebody stands up, and then the person next to them stands up, and then the next and the next. And before you know it, actually within seconds, you have a wave propagating from one end of the arena to the other.
As the fish aligned themselves with each other, these waves moved through the school 10 times as fast as any individual fish could swim, the same way a wave in a stadium crowd moves faster than people can. Ian Cousin is a biologist at Princeton University who studies this kind of behavior in everything from fish to locusts to people. He says each fish has to copy the movement of the next fish so that the whole mass can move almost instantly as one.
It just seems that the fish are very sensitive to the behavior of those around them, and this can cause these sort of very rapidly propagating waves of change of behavior, and therefore it changes the population dynamics, you know, incredibly rapidly.
This is the first time scientists have observed such a chain reaction, start to finish, on such a large scale, according to Nicholas McCreese. His new sonar, it's called Ocean Acoustic Waveguide Remote Sensing, made it possible.
Below the surface, things were going on that nobody knew about. And it's because we just couldn't see it. With this new technology, we're essentially taking the darkness out of the ocean and just seeing things that we just couldn't see before. I mean, literally city-states of fish.
And this city-state moved. Overnight, the entire school swam south to warmer waters to mate. The next day, the fish returned to where they started and dispersed. And when the sun set the next evening, it all started again. Ian Cousin at Princeton says mating exposes the fish to predators, and behavior like this reduces each fish's risk of getting eaten.
It's very important that they synchronize their behavior to mate at the same time and to move together into particularly dangerous parts of the ocean.
Nicholas McCreese, a professor at MIT, compares the remote sensing project to what astronomers do.
When you put the Hubble telescope out there and look into the heavens, you don't know what you're going to see. And it's the same thing in the ocean. I mean, it's dark. It's dark like space. And if you can't sense it with your eyes and then you augment them with these other tools, you find things that you just weren't expecting.
So Nicholas McCreese was, in the end, I think, quite philosophical. He was comparing what biologists and engineers do to what astronomers do. You build a gadget, and guess what? You find out things you didn't know before. And in fact, that makes a pretty good segue to the next story, which is about astronomers and what they're able to do. And in this case, what they were able to do for the first time ever. They tracked an asteroid as it burned up in the Earth's atmosphere, and then they recovered pieces of that very asteroid in the middle of the desert in Sudan. It was quite an amazing story, so I phoned up one of the lead scientists to find out how they did it. Oh, hello. This is Chris Joyce from National Public Radio.
Hello, Chris. Peter Yaniskis here.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, pleasure. I hope so.
Peter Yaniskis has certainly been in the news about a discovery that was made last year, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You've been keeping it quiet for a while, but it all started with an asteroid that tumbled through the atmosphere. And, well, why don't you pick it up from there? What was the scenario, though? This asteroid hit the atmosphere, and tell us what happened.
Yes. On October 6th last year, astronomers at the Catalina Sky Survey in Arizona discovered a small asteroid that was heading straight at us. And that was the very first time that an asteroid had been discovered that was going to impact the Earth. The asteroid was tracked by astronomers on the Earth. And then 20 hours later, it crashed in the atmosphere over northern Sudan in the Nubian Desert.
And normally when these things come into the atmosphere, meteorites have come, or asteroids and meteorites have hit the Earth before, nobody's ever been able to tell exactly where they came from. They just show it. So at that point, folks called you up at NASA's SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence?
Yes.
So what did you do?
Well, what could I do? I decided that perhaps it was a good idea to establish contacts with local scientists in Sudan, and I came in contact with Dr. Mawia Shedad. He's a physics professor at the University of Khartoum. And I basically gave him as much advice as I could about how to collect observations of this fireball in the sky. I was hoping that the eyewitness accounts could help us pinpoint where meteorites may have fallen in the desert.
Then you decided to go there yourself and actually go out there and look for these meteorites.
Yeah, I was enticed by some fantastic images that Mario sent to me. They were taken by eyewitnesses that had just whipped out their cell phone and taken cell phone pictures of something really big and bright in the sky, a very large cloud of dust.
Amateur astronomers. I mean, they're everywhere. Anybody with a cell phone can be an amateur astronomer.
Yes, and these days it's cell phones and security cameras and that sort of things that pick up these astronomical events. They're very rare, but
nothing goes unnoticed.
Cameras, yeah. So this cloud was seen clearly in the pictures, but it didn't have any star background that I could use to measure how high the cloud was in the sky. And so I suggested perhaps I could come and visit and interview some of the eyewitnesses, and perhaps that would help see if it would be possible at all to do a search campaign. And at the same time, the University of Khartoum was very interested in trying to organize a dedicated search, and they saw me as sort of the outside expert that could help them pinpoint where to go and what to find.
So what kind of search did you mount? How many people took part in this?
I was very surprised. I traveled there. I gave a talk at the university, and then we traveled. Immediately that same day, we traveled north. We went next day all the way to the area where the meteorite fell. We talked with eyewitnesses there. We went even further north to a little town called Wadi Halfa on the border with Egypt, and went to the place where these cell phone pictures were taken, and I was able to take star background images that from the very spot where the people were taking the pictures of the cloud. We were able to sort of get a sense on what the eyewitnesses saw in the sky, and then traveled back to the area where the fall was, and there was a bus waiting for us with 45 students and staff from the university eager to come and help find these meteorites.
Were these the people who had the cell phones in the first place that took the photos?
No. These were volunteers that were very excited to come and see if they could help us find some of these meteorites in the field. And so we spent most of the next day creating our own road into the desert for 29 kilometers. We're just driving cars on our GPS in a straight line following the asteroid trajectory. It's a really remote region. There's no road there. There's just sand.
So eventually this team of yours did eventually start to find pieces of the meteorite.
Yes, exactly. So we lined the students up. We started searching. We didn't know really what to look for. I was telling everybody it had to be very dark, and also I expected a layer of glass. We walked for 2 hours. It was the end of the day. The sun was low in the sky. We needed to wrap things up, and I'd looked at many things, examples that students had come to me, and nothing was a meteorite, and then a car came to me and said, oh, a student has found something. And so,
what did you think?
Well, I thought, oh, no, not again. I was really ready to go home.
Yeah.
And then I jumped in the car, I drove to the student, and the student, called Mohammed Alamin, showed me this this rock, which clearly was a meteorite. And so he said, yeah, this is what we're looking for. And then, of course, everybody started wanted to see it and started shouting and singing. And it was quite a spectacle. It was just wonderful. The bus even came driving up to where we were. And it was.
So everybody wanted to go out and find more?
Yeah, because then, of course, we knew that something could be found. And we sort of continued walking along the path of the asteroid. And we walked for about 8 hours that day and found 5 more meteorites. And they were all very black, very sort of scruffy looking.
Now, the way I understand it is that no one has ever tracked an asteroid to the point where it exploded and then found pieces of that asteroid before.
Exactly. And to our big surprise and joy, we discovered that because of the unusual circumstances, this thing exploding high up and a little bit surviving and we picking up those little bits of little scraps that survived, we had a unique meteorite in our hands. There were no similar meteorites in our collections.
What makes it unique?
It's very porous, it's very fragile, and it's very dark. And it now turns out that because we can, we saw this asteroid in space, and we were able to see how it reflected sunlight, and we can do the same thing for the meteorite and see how it reflects light. We know this meteorite comes from that asteroid, and we can make that link. And for the first time, we sort of dotted the line between a meteorite in our hand and a particular class of asteroids out there in space.
Well, it sounds quite like a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
It was. Yeah, for me, it was a great adventure. It was a tremendous experience to visit Sudan and to get to go and search for something that wasn't quite certain in the beginning. It was a bit of a long shot. We basically pulled off a sample return mission.
Yes.
We went to an asteroid. And
without the spacecraft.
Without the spacecraft and without all the long waiting and so on.
Yeah, saved a lot of money that way.
And saved a lot of money. This was very exciting.
Okay. Well, Peter Yeniskis, thank you very much for talking with us about your asteroid 2008 TC3, it's called.
It's a pleasure.
One more thing for this week's podcast. This week, the U.S. billionaire Charles Simony blasted into space for his second time. He was aboard a Soyuz capsule headed for the International Space Station. Simony is a former Microsoft guru who helped create popular programs like Word and Excel. When he took his first trip just about 2 years ago up into space, my colleague Nell Boyce did a little digging to find out about what he was like and how he got up into space, and she prepared this report.
Charles Simony has been training in Russia for 7 months. The night before he left for the launch site in Kazakhstan, he took a break from packing to chat on the phone. He says, growing up in Hungary, he was crazy about space.
I knew everything about space. You know, I knew the names of space dogs.
The space dogs?
Yes, of course. You know, Laika and Chernushka and Zvedochka, the dogs that have been sent to space.
Simony never thought he'd follow those famous space dogs. But a couple of years ago, he went on a tour of a Russian space center where he got to see cosmonauts blast off.
And the people who organize these tours, Space Adventures, suggested that I might be interested in actually flying on those rockets.
He just couldn't believe it. Was he really qualified?
There's the question of health, the question of age, the question of eyesight, and who knows what else.
And money, of course.
I think that the money, in my case, it wasn't the greatest consideration.
Forbes magazine says Simony is a billionaire, so $25 million seemed doable. He was healthy enough to go, and he knew Space Adventures could deliver. The company was founded almost a decade ago. Its astronaut advisory board includes Buzz Aldrin, and it has an agreement with the Russian Space Agency. Simony will be the fifth paying customer it's sent up. On Saturday, he will blast off with 2 cosmonauts and spend over a week orbiting Earth on the space station. So far, Space Adventures is the only company to put customers into space. But space consultant Alan Ladwig says it won't be long before others do.
You've got Virgin Galactic out there with Richard Branson. You've got Blue Origin, rocket plane Kistler. There's any number of companies that are out there going after a market that they believe could be close to $1 billion over the next 10 to 15 years.
Ladwig used to work at NASA. He says 20 years ago, the idea of space tourism seemed laughable.
It had what they called at NASA at the time, the snicker factor.
But now, companies have ambitious agendas. Eric Anderson, founder of Space Adventures, plans to send a pair of tourists around the moon.
The price tag on the lunar expedition, which could launch as early as 2009, is $100 million per seat.
He's dead serious. He says the Russians have the technology, and he's got the customers.
We are fairly certain who would go on the first mission. I mean, we even have takers for the second mission, potentially.
Now, a $100 million moonshot is pretty far out. But other companies are offering cheaper options, and there's clearly a demand. Loretta and George Whitesides live in Washington, D.C., where they both work for organizations that promote space exploration.
We've had the idea to go to space together for a long time. I mean, obviously, we're sort of space junkies.
They couldn't afford a Russian flight. Instead, they bought tickets from Virgin Galactic. Starting in about 2 years, this company says it will be sending people more than 65 miles up. Loretta Whiteside says the trip will be brief, but eventful.
You'll be up there for about 7 minutes. You'll be able to see the curvature of the Earth and the blackness of space. And as soon as they turn off the rocket engine, that's when you'll experience weightlessness.
The cost? George Whiteside says about what they'd spend on a house.
For two tickets, it'd be $400,000. You know, this is really expensive, but within our range. You know, it's possible.
If that seems beyond your budget, there's no need to give up yet. For a mere $3,500, you can float like an astronaut without leaving Earth. Noah McMahon works for the Zero Gravity Corporation.
We offer a chance for anybody to experience weightlessness.
The company flies a big airplane up and down, like a roller coaster. This produces bursts of zero gravity that last around 25 seconds.
When you're in the airplane, you have no idea that you're even in an airplane. It's like you're in a magic room and everything starts to float.
Over 2,000 customers have done it. Physicist Stephen Hawking is going up in a couple of weeks. And the company has just signed a deal with The Sharper Image to sell tickets at your local mall. For former Microsoftie Charles Simoni, these are all signs that something is really happening in the space industry, just like things changed in his field, computers. When he started out, computers were just for big corporations and governments.
It was the involvement of civilians, the personal computer, that really made the industry explode with the energy and creativity.
He says, sure, his ticket was expensive, but he hopes that by buying it, he's helping to someday make space travel a lot cheaper for everyone else. Nell Boyce, NPR News.
Ground control to Major Tom. Thanks very much for listening to On Science. That's it for this week. Next week, Joe Palca will be back. And thanks for listening. I'm Chris Joyce.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition, and may God's love be with you.